For the week of November 8th, 2009, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 28, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And at Yankee Stadium in New York, still celebrating the New York Yankees World Series win, I'm Michael Giltz.
Wow, you're still celebrating? It's like a week later.
I've got a whole year to celebrate.
Boo Yankees.
Hey, we scraped by on $220 million. We're scrappy come from behind kids.
I actually sent you a text message on Wednesday night to see if you were at the stadium. Were you actually at the sixth game of the World Series?
Oh, yeah. I have season tickets in the bleachers. I have two seats, and I've been there for every postseason game since 2000, since they started selling season tickets in the bleachers. And I was there for the win. Absolutely. First time I was actually there in the stadium for the win. So that was very exciting for the final clincher.
Well, that must have been a lot of fun.
Oh, it was great.
That's pretty cool, actually.
A little later in the show, we'll be talking about the television ratings for this year's World Series. We have a ton of stuff to talk about today. Later in the program, John Horn from the Los Angeles Times will be joining us to talk about Spider-Man, the Broadway musical. But first, Michael, why don't you run down the box office results for North America?
Of course, because there's lots of chances to make fun of me. So let's do it.
I have a feeling I know what he's talking about.
There's a couple. First comes the number one at the box office was A Christmas Carol, the Jim Carrey 3D movie, which made $31 million, about $10 to $20 million less than a lot of people predicted. Number two is Michael Jackson's This Is It with a terrific hold in its second weekend. It grossed $14 million, which frankly makes it alone, just that one second weekend makes it one of the top grossing concert films of all time. Third was George Clooney's movie, The Men Who Stare at Goats, which made $13 million, which is actually not bad for this type of George Clooney movie.
Oh, it's so bad, that movie. Don't get me started.
Fourth is The Fourth Kind, a horror flick of sorts that made $12.5 million. Fifth was Paranormal Activity, the biggest indie success of the year. It made I did too. It made $8.6 million and is just about to pass $100 million. Number six was the anonymous horror movie, The Box, which made $7.8 million. Number seven was Couples Retreat at $6.4 million. It's about to pass $100 million as well. Thank you, press junketers. Number eight was Law Abiding Citizen, which is still chugging along. It's made $60 million so far total. Number nine is Where the Wild Things Are, which made $4.2 million. That's at $69 million. Number 10 is Astro Boy, which is fading fast. It's got a total of $15 million. And of course, the other big news beyond Michael Jackson's wildly good second week performance, A Christmas Carol soft opening, is Precious, which only opened on 18 screens but made $1.8 million thanks to a sensational $100,000 per screen average.
That is a huge per screen average.
I remember when Platoon did that back in the, was that the 80s? I remember in college seeing that figure in Variety and going, wow, $100,000 per screen. It was unheard of at the time, I believe.
Well, it's not shocking to me that the film is doing well, at least in its opening weekend. It opened in major markets, Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, I believe Dallas. You know, that's the power of Oprah Winfrey and Tyler Perry. They got people to show up for the opening of this movie. Almost every single showing was sold out in the cities in which it was showing. 18 different theaters, $1.8 million. It's already the fourth highest Sundance Grand Jury Prize winner this decade.
Yeah, it's a definite huge. They've been talking about it for 10 months, and you saw articles everywhere about the movie. So the pent up demand to actually see it from regular filmgoers is obviously tremendous. I saw Christmas Carol and Paranormal Activity this weekend. I'd already seen Precious. Karen, what did you see this weekend?
Well, first of all, I want to address the fact that you didn't like Precious when you saw it at Sundance, right?
I saw it at Cannes, and I did not like it. I thought Monique was really good. I thought the lead girl was pretty good. I thought Monique would get an Oscar nomination, very possibly. But I had lots of problems with the direction and the production. Yes, absolutely.
I still plan on seeing that. I saw Paranormal Activity finally this weekend. Oh my God, I loved it.
Hey, were you scared?
Yeah, I was terrified.
I saw it in a theater that was mostly, I was literally the only person in the theater. I saw it at 5 o'clock on Friday. And I have to admit, when the bed sheets moved, I said out loud in the theater, I said, wow, that's kind of creepy.
Hey, wait a second. I haven't seen it. Don't spoil anything. No spoilers. No,
I said things like, oh, my God.
Since I didn't have a full crowd, I was glad I was all alone. That sort of made it kind of a nice, weird feeling, too. But I was a little disappointed in the ending, but I thought it was clever and well done. And I liked the casting of the two people. They looked like normal people.
Were you a little surprised by how well Precious did?
Not really, I guess, because of the hoopla for 10 months. I mean, so, you know, and you've got Oprah and Tyler Perry banging the drum. No, I'm not really surprised. It's still a huge opening. I mean, no question about it.
Well, nearly made $2 million and it only cost $10 million to make. So, of course, it's expanding this week to...
It cost $10
million? $10 million to make.
Yeah, it's clearly, I mean, if this movie makes $20, $30 million, it's a huge success and it looks poised to do that. It's going to steamroll through the awards season and just get bigger and bigger. I was more surprised by how Michael Jackson's This Is It did in his second weekend. I in the middle of the week, I noticed and I put a note in the thing. I don't know if you guys saw it, but on Wednesday, it made over $2 million. And I said, wow, this is really holding up well. People are going back or they're seeing it and the word of mouth is good. According to, I believe, Roger Friedman of The Hollywood Reporter, it's now made $185 million worldwide, which means it's close to profitability. Another $15 million and it will be in the black.
That's right, and that's just
be serving you your crow.
That's right.
What about a Christmas Carol? Did anybody see that?
No desire.
Well, it was not a train wreck, which I feared. I actually thought Jim Carrey gave a really good performance as Scrooge. It's pretty subtle. It didn't really need to be in 3D or animated, particularly, and since it cost $200 million, I'm not quite sure what the advantages of doing it animated rather than live action. But the action sequences were ridiculous. They were so unnecessary and plugged in. There was literally one 5-minute action scene, and it's so moronic. You just roll your eyes. There's a point where Scrooge is on his back, on the ground, in the middle of the street with a barrel, and he's spinning a barrel with his legs. And I have no idea why or how it happened, but I'm watching it thinking, what is this? Why is this? Why are we watching this? This has nothing to do with A Christmas Carol. But Sperling, maybe you can talk about this. The tracking, again, was so wildly off. And this seems to be the theme of the year, though not the last 2 years. They can't track movies anymore. They have no idea what movies are going to make on opening weekend.
Certainly there are companies that actually do the tracking. There are some very well-known companies within the industry that go out and they poll moviegoers or potential moviegoers both at theaters and in malls and via phone. And they ask them things like, do you know about Robert Zemeckis's A Christmas Carol? Do you plan on seeing it? Is it a must-see? How many times do you plan on seeing it in the theater? And that's where they get the tracking numbers. These numbers are very important to studio distribution executives. Usually, motion picture exhibitors don't get tracking numbers so much.
Well, they're in the papers. We see them. We hear about them the week before.
The tracking numbers? I've never known them to be in papers.
They were planning it would make $40 to $50 million. I kept reading that.
Oh, I thought we were talking about like the actual like the grids that we used to get when we were all working at studios.
I'm referring to the predictions of what it's going to make opening weekend and how wildly off they seem to be again and again and again.
Well, those are journalists and media outlets predicting from their own prognosticators and
don't they call
experts.
These companies and have the companies tell them that's what they believe?
I don't know. That's a good question.
That's a really good question. Where do they get their numbers?
We'll ask John Horn when he's here later in the show.
We shall. I wonder how much social media plays into that because we were talking last week about or maybe 2 weeks ago, about how Twitter has played such a large part in that, word of mouth and distributing word of mouth. You know, if people do their research right online, you can tell what people are talking about.
Well, it's not as big as some people predicted, but $31 million is okay. And a movie like this should play for the next 8 weeks and will probably have a long life on DVD.
Did any of you read this story that was on IndieWire about the top grossing Sundance Film Festival winners and how they did at the box office?
Yes.
I thought it was kind of interesting. They highlighted what I've always thought, which is that the audience award is more important than the grand jury prize because the audience award winners are the films that go on to do bigger box office. These are films like Hedwig and the Angry Inch, The Station Agent, Maria Full of Grace, Hustle and Flow. I believe Napoleon Dynamite is in there somewhere, which made $44 million.
But to me, I think it's a reflection how Sundance actually does focus on independent films. I mean, they're not, you know, even their top grossing films that were the audience winners that even competed. Napoleon Dynamite is the top one. It made 44 and The Bedroom made 35. Garden State made 26 million. Memento made 25. You know, where 20 million is the upper limit for five of the movies in the past decade, Hustle and Flow. And then you're back down to 12 million for Sunshine Cleaning, 9 million for You Can Count on Me. So this is clearly, at least Sundance, which seems so glitzy, is actually sticking to independent films.
And of course, this year's Sundance is next year's Academy Awards.
Wow, rarely.
Oh, I think that was a segue alert.
That was a segue alert.
What do you guys make of of Alec Baldwin and Steve Martin being tapped to host the awards.
I really like the idea. I think Steve Martin is very funny, and Alec Baldwin can be very funny, and I don't know if you've seen him on Saturday Night Live, but they're very funny, and together I think they can play off of one another.
I want to know why Steve Martin.
Well, he hosted it before. He's great.
Yeah,
but why now? It seemed like such a random choice to me.
Because they have their movie coming out together in Christmas.
Oh, they do?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. This is where I go off into a corner and pretend that I work in the entertainment business. I had no idea. Oh, is that the one with Meryl Streep?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Right. All right. Well, now it makes sense. Because to me, I was like, okay, well, Alec Baldwin, I get it, you know, 30 Rock. And then I'm like, but why Steve Martin? All right. Well, I just hope they don't hog the stage and all the time. Because, no, that takes an awful lot of precious time.
Yeah, the film is called It's Complicated, directed by Nancy Meyers. It opens Christmas Day, so it will have just been in the theaters, a few weeks before. So it'll be towards the end of its run. So it's not really going to promote the film, because the film will already be out and basically done by the time of the Oscars.
Yeah, but still a PR move.
Yeah, and I like the fact that they're in this mock feud, Alec Baldwin and Steve Martin, over who has hosted Saturday Night Live more times. And I think Steve Martin is leading by one. He's hosted it 15 times to Alec Baldwin's 14. And because of that, in the press release, Alec Baldwin said, "I don't play the banjo, but I am thrilled to be hosting the Oscars. It's the opportunity of a lifetime." And of course, Alec Baldwin was referring to Steve Martin's whole bluegrass stint. He's out there playing banjo with a bluegrass band at Carnegie Hall and different venues these days.
And just got nominated for a top bluegrass award.
That's right. Steve Martin, on the other hand, said, "I am happy to co-host the Oscars with my enemy, Alec Baldwin."
You know, I think that maybe it's a terrible thing to say because I'm not negating their talent, but this seems like a really dated choice. This seems like so like late 80s, early 90s. Couldn't they have found somebody who was like...
Alec Baldwin's on the number one Emmy-winning show of the past two, three seasons.
But that's
never
that's
been
the only
as a
reason
comic.
Why he might be relevant. I mean, I would have found, Tina Fey a little bit more relevant.
Zac Efron?
No, well, maybe not quite like that. But
I know what you mean, but you tend to be an older, more august presence, don't you, to host a show like that rather than the young,
hot
thing.
Not if you want to get young viewers.
Well, Steve Martin's in tons of family movies like The Pink Panther and The Pink Panther 2 and Cheaper by the Dozen, so young people know his work.
Yeah, so that'll get, like, you know, my mom watching, but she would probably watch anyway. But, if they want to get in, you know, Generation Y and Generation Z or whatever we're calling them, if they don't watch Alec Baldwin on 30 Rock, to them, these are just two old men hosting the Oscars.
Why didn't they ask Neil Patrick Harris?
I don't know.
I think he had already said that, like, he probably wouldn't do it if asked because he feels overexposed, so maybe they didn't even bother asking him. But he would have been a good choice, despite not really having been in any movies except Harold and Kumar. But, I mean, if they had gotten, like, you know, Judd Apatow's crew to do it, I don't know. I mean, that's how you would have gotten in the next generation.
But that's not a host. You know, a host is just an august presence. And I'm with you. I hope they just do a little funny shtick at the beginning, and then that's it. They just keep it moving.
I'm so afraid. I'm so afraid that these guys are going to hijack the show.
Yeah, we don't need filler. It's 4 hours long.
Yeah.
Well, let's see if we can get John Horn on, and maybe he can fill us in on some of his thoughts on who's hosting the Oscars. Although, technically, we're supposed to be talking to him about Spider-Man the musical.
Let's talk to him about Spider-Man the musical.
Okay, we won't ask him about Oscars.
Turn off the dark.
Turn off
the dark? You have to say the proper name.
Turn off the dark.
Isn't that awful?
Yes.
More like Spider-Man goes dark.
Okay, joining us now via Skype is John Horn, who is a staff writer at the Los Angeles Times and previously has been the senior editor at Premiere Magazine and a senior writer at Newsweek. If you want to hear John with Kim Masters, you can do so every Monday on KCRW.com. You're part of the Hollywood Banter, which is
that is true.
Which is kind of like this show, but done in about 5 minutes. So we take up more of your time.
But you pay better.
Yes. much better. Now, this week, John, you wrote a story in the LA Times about Spider-Man the Musical, which was really an in-depth story. It seemed like it may have taken quite a while to put that story together.
It took off and on a couple months of reporting. I mean, since I normally cover the film business and not musical theater, it was something I was doing kind of on the side around my other reporting. But I have written about the theater throughout my career. I was a theater major in college. I'm always interested in it. And it just turns out there are a fair number of people who work in the film business who are also very active in the theater business.
Well, John, this is Michael. I love the story. I love the details, especially you got a hold of the script and were describing how the show would open. Were they eager and happy to talk to you because they wanted to make sure they quelled any sense of bad buzz over the sort of musical chairs surrounding the producers leading the show, or were they wary about speaking with you?
They had absolutely no interest in speaking to me. and in fact, all the people who gave me information about the show did so on condition of anonymity because, one, they were not authorized to speak about the show, and two, they were nervous about saying something about the show on the record, because they may end up being investors. Some of the people I talked to might actually be investors. And the publicist for the production said the same thing, that the show would not operate and that director Julie Taymor would not speak to me either.
And Julie Taymor, of course, has done Broadway shows previously, specifically The Lion King, which was a huge hit.
Well, the amazing statistic about The Lion King is that it's actually, you always think of the Spider-Man movies as some of the biggest, highest grossing films in Hollywood history. And yet The Lion King musical is actually not only outgrossed The Lion King movie, but outgrossed all of the three Spider-Man movies combined.
That's right. The Spider-Man movies have made $2.5 billion. And The Lion King musical on Broadway and its touring companies have made $3.6 billion worldwide.
And correct. And I mean, it helps too that when you go see The Lion King Broadway or in any other theater, you're paying $70, if not $100. Go see the Spider-Man movies. If you're paying $10, you live in a big city.
There's some talk that this show may never actually be produced. It may never come off. Do you think that's a real fear?
I think there's two possible scenarios. I think the question you have is whether or not it will come off in its presently incarnated form. I think that's still a long shot. They just brought in, the day after the LA Times story was published, the producer of the show announced they'd brought in somebody named Michael Cole to refinance and produce the show. I think he is probably still several million, if not $10 or $15 million short of where the budget needs to get to. So if he's able to raise that money, I think the show as currently imagined could be staged. And there's some people who think the more likely outcome is that everything will kind of fall apart. The show as it stands will be closed, and then a new production will be mounted sometime next year, after Disney acquires Marvel. And Disney is one of the most successful producers of Broadway shows, including The Lion King, Beauty and the Beast, and Marvel is the rights holder to the Spider-Man license. But in the new year, Disney will complete its purchase of Marvel's.
Well, I'm a theater geek, and I go to the theater all the time, and I love shows, and I love the business side of it, and it can be really hard to get hard information on a show. A couple things in the article were just amazing. One was the budget, which is, you know, right now estimated to be roughly $52 million, which is exponentially more than any other show I've ever heard of in history. And two was that the running costs of the show, not to get too wonky, but the running costs are estimated to be at about $1 million, which is more than most shows ever gross in a week. And so this show, if it was lucky enough to gross, to be sold out and gross, say, the top grossing film on Broadway right now makes about $1.4 million. I think that's Wicked. And right below that is Bill Ed at $1.3 million. So if it costs you $1 million to run per week and you're only netting $300,000 a week, you got to run for 4 years just to break even if you're costing $50 million. And that's, you know, planning a show to break even after it runs 4 years is almost insane.
Right. And I think the people I talked to who were close to the show, again, some of them potential investors, some of them possible investors. I have to be careful about who my sources are. But they were those were the two numbers that were astonishing to them. And it wasn't just that it cost $52 million to stage, which is, as I said in the story, double the cost of some of the more expensive shows in Broadway history, including Lord of the Rings, and probably about double the cost of The Lion King. But because of the staging, because of the aerial choreography, the amount of personnel that be there every day to get the show up was unbelievable. And I think that's what really contributed to the $1 million a week sunk cost. And there was a legitimate question that I don't know the specific answer to, is whether or not the Marvel royalty was on top of that. So it actual running costs might actually be higher once the Marvel royalty is calculated.
Do you think that Disney might actually want to see this production fail so that they can have a shot at producing their own version?
Yes.
Wow. Well, how do you really feel?
You have to understand that Marvel is not an investor in the show. Marvel has what has been described to me as an 8% royalty, which is another, and the way their royalty is defined is also very generous to company. So that regardless of what happens with the show, Marvel will have no capital at risk and could potentially make a lot of money. Disney wants to see the show happen because come January, Marvel will be Disney. So I think they absolutely want to see the show happen, but they might be in a better position to see it happen on more financially reasonable terms so that it could not only succeed in its own run, but maybe travel. I mean, the thing the story raises is it would be very difficult to travel this show. If you establish it on Broadway as this almost arena event show and then you take it on the road, I mean, there's 7 Lion King shows going right now. The potential for traveling the show around the world would be limited in an attempt to do it in the way that it would be conceived for Broadway.
Well, John, that brings up a point because they brought in this rock producer. The spectacle of the show and the high running cost, it made me think of Starlight Express, this horrible Andrew Lloyd Webber musical that played much bigger spaces on the road than it did in Broadway, much bigger than the typical Broadway show. They usually play like 5,000 seaters, which are huge by Broadway standards, but this show, Starlight Express, was playing even bigger spaces, and I thought maybe the only way it could work financially is if somehow the special effects and the rigging can work in a hard top, that they maybe could, you know, take it to 10,000 and 20,000 seat arenas where rock shows play. You know, if that stuff can be expanded out and the special effects and stuff can fit in those 10, 20,000 seat arenas, that's the only way I could see the show making any money. You know, the Broadway is a loss leader to get the attention, and then they take it on the road, and instead of playing those 5,000 seat arenas, they're playing, you know, 20,000 seat rock arenas.
Yeah, I think the other scenario that some people have kicked around is the Cirque du Soleil model, like in Las Vegas, where it's almost kind of a custom built theater that accommodates the show that might have larger capacity, and that the theater itself is designed from the ground up to accommodate the production. I mean, I think a lot of the costs are the $6 million renovation of the Hilton Theater to accommodate all the aerial work. If you built a dedicated space, that in some ways it would be a lot of money, but you would be able to stage the show in the ambition that Julie Taymor has for it. Whether or not you would still be able to travel the show, I think, remains a great question.
I like what you say about it. You say that more than 40 stagehands are needed to operate the musical's backstage rigging, and this is to make Spider-Man, you know, fly around the theater and stick to the walls and do all of the tricks we've become so familiar with from the movies. But then you say it makes the Phantom of the Opera's crashing chandelier look like a simple summer stock trick. I thought that was a great, great line.
Well, I was fortunate enough to see a DVD that the producers of the show put together in trying to attract new investors. And for legal reasons, we did not post that DVD on our website, but it did showcase some of the aerial ambition for the show. And I have to say, it was spectacular. I mean, there's a sequence where Peter Parker learns to kind of walk on the walls. And this has to be presented in, you know, live action. And they were able to come up with this rigging where there's movable walls. And Peter Parker is in a harness. And he really walks around his bedroom walls while this U2 music is playing. And there were also their lead creative... big creative leap is the creation of this temptress named Arachna. And when she appears, she weaves this giant web on stage. And there was a test that was done in Los Angeles of what this giant kind of human loom would look like. And it was spectacular. You have to imagine, you know, 7 aerialists kind of swinging back and forth on these giant pieces of white cloth. Between them are flying giant pieces of blue fabric to create, in real time, this web that's as big as the proscenium in most theaters. So that money, that $52 million, was going to get you a lot of aerial effects, and a lot of the staging was just jaw drop.
What were the songs like?
The songs I thought were really good. I think what was interesting about the music is that if you listen to it, you would kind of feel that it was written by talented rock musicians, but it was also written in the vernacular of the Broadway musical. So they were writing for different voices. They were writing for Evan Rachel Wood, sung on the version that CD I listened to. I think Jim Sturgis, who was originally kind of penciled in a early workshop of the musical, was singing Peter Parker's Spider-Man. But, you know, there were ballads, there were rock songs, there were kind of new orchestrations, new melodies. It didn't strike me as typical U2 music, and I mean this in the highest possible compliment. It sounded incredibly American. It sounded like it had its roots in, you know, and Sondheim and Rodgers and Hart, but it also felt like it was modern rock music. The music, I think, was spectacular.
And we should say that the music is composed by Bono and The Edge from U2.
Correct.
And you have some quotes from them. Where did you get those quotes? Was that when they played the Rose Bowl here in Pasadena?
They came. I live in Pasadena. They came by my house on the way to the concert, wanted to have a beer, and Bono and
You watched the YouTube streaming version of their concert?
I only live a couple miles from the Rose Bowl, and they just happened to stop by on their bikes on the way down there. No, my colleague Jeff Boucher, who covers pop music and all things kind of fanboy for the paper on his Hero Complex blog, was doing an interview with Edge and Bono ahead of the Rose Bowl show in Pasadena, and I slipped him $5 and said, ask a couple questions about Spider-Man. And he did. I still owe him the $5.
What I love is Bono's or Edge's quote where he says, the visuals and the music are amazing.
The songwriters must be brilliant. But you have to remember, too, that these guys, I mean, they've been working on the show for multiple years. And as the story pointed out, that Tony Adams, the original producer, essentially died in the Edge's arms at a signing ceremony of a stroke. So they not only have a long time personal commitment, they also have kind of a emotional commitment to this show. I mean, they've been involved through the most unimaginable tragedy, the death of a producer. And also they've invested a lot of their own time in trying to see if they can make this show happen.
Well, certainly The Edge should be credited with a lot of the way U2 sounds. And I thought the quote that you got out of him, or Jeff Boucher got out of him, is very interesting. He says, the easiest job we've ever done when it comes to the pure joy is what he said. For me, it's this wonderful thing of escaping from the first-person songwriting to disappear into these outside characters. It's just been a thrill ride. Oh, that's actually Bono. You spend so much time digging up diamonds in your own music. It's a treat to dig in somebody else's dirt. To work on these songs was like a playpen.
I think having listened to the music, I understand completely what he's saying. I mean, they are working in a format, you know, where, I mean, a song, a rock song in some ways is, it may be communicating an idea. It may be communicating an emotion, but it's not communicating a narrative. I mean, songs in musical theater have to advance story. And they have to do all the things that a rock song does. They have to be musically interesting, and they have to kind of grab you emotionally, but they also have to advance character. And I think what they were really adept at doing is using, you know, their songwriting skills to in furtherance of a totally different goal, which is narrative. Just as, you know, Green Day did on their American Idiot album, this felt more like almost a concept album in terms of how it was designed and how it was executed.
Well, John, you've had more chance than most people to see the concepts of what they're doing and the production design and the songs. Would you invest in the show?
If I had a couple million lying around, I guess I would invest in it theoretically, but I think the financials are so daunting. As somebody said in the story, there are varying estimates about this. It would have to run at capacity for 3, 4, 5 years to break even. So if you're an investor in the show, you have to absolutely take a very long-term time horizon investment approach. I think the real issue for other investors is that, you know, you may not be coming into the first position. There may be other people who will be paid ahead of you. And I think in some ways that's why future investors are waiting on the sidelines to see if the show falls apart. Obviously, that would result in some litigation and whatever else goes along with that, and then kind of start it all over in a better position. So I guess to answer your question, I think the show is, what I've heard and seen is brilliant, but I think the financials are nightmarish.
So creatively you're excited, but it may not make sense financially at the moment.
And I think that's what everybody around the show says. I mean, I talked to one potential investor who thought it, and who has done a lot of very impressive, you know, you would know a lot of this guy's shows. He thought it was creatively one of the most interesting things he had seen, but there was no way that he could run the numbers and make them make sense. And on top of that, and the article certainly references this, that the Chicago lawyer, David Garfinkel, who was involved in the show, had been, according to any number of people, kind of unwilling to cede creative control. And the potential investors who were coming in wanted to be able to call the shot.
Now, I know that you have to, we don't want to keep you too long, but when you're working on a story like this one, it takes a while to put together, and certainly word must have gotten out that you're working on it. Is it hard to keep the story under wraps and not have somebody in the blogosphere come out and try and scoop you?
It is. I mean, I think what you worry about more than anything else is somebody, some other news outlet actually doing the same story, even in a lesser version. So, I mean, I cover the film business for the LA Times. The New York Times has a full-time theater writer named Patrick Healy. So, and there's another person whose stories I've not read. I think he works for the New York Post, Guy Riedel.
Michael Riedel or whatever.
Riedel. So there are people whose full-time jobs it is to cover theater. I do this 1% of my time. So I think that the paper's concern was that this was a big story and that somebody would naturally not just stumble across it, but just know that it was happening and write it. So you're less concerned about somebody kind of poaching your reporting as you are about somebody doing the story in whatever version they're doing. And I mean, I think it was very fortunate that we published the story, I think, the day that they met to refinance the show. Had we waited another day or a week, you know, we might have been too late. So the race is you know, to get the story right and get all the reporting in place, and then you just go to bed and pray that somebody else doesn't do the same or similar story before you've had a chance to publish yours.
Well, you did a good job, and anybody who loves theater will want to read it just so they can hear all the details about the show. But there's one thing I wanted to know that you didn't, I didn't hear you nail down in the story. Whose horrific name was it to call the show Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark?
Somebody explained to me why it was called that, and the short version of that long and not totally impressive answer was that they wanted to make sure that the audience knew this wasn't Spider-Man the movie, that it was darker, that it was edgier, that it was, as Hollywood loves to say, not a remake, but a reimagination. and I think they thought, I don't even know what it means. I mean, I've read the play and I've listened to the music and I still don't know what it means.
Spider-Man the musical.
Yeah, I think their concern was that sounded corny. I think they wanted to make clear that this was a work that would stand on its own. And I think, of course, if the show ever gets staged, they will not have much difficulty proving that to the audience.
Well, John, I want to thank you for taking the time out of your day to join us to discuss your piece. Certainly, our listeners should go to latimes.com if you don't live in Los Angeles or live outside the country, because a lot of your writing appears on the blogs there. You know, I get the newspaper every day, and I, of course, immediately turn to see what you or Patrick Goldstein or Ben Fritz or your entire team there has written, because you guys have really been doing a great job of late covering the entertainment industry.
We try, and we appreciate when people take note. And I think if people check in to latimes.com to look, find my story, they can, but they should check in at latimes.com every day and make it their homepage.
Visit latimes.com. In the entertainment section, we'll place a link to it in the show notes. Of course, there will be a link to the article that we're speaking of in the show notes as well. And John, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Maybe we'll all meet at the opening of Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark.
As if you'd get an invite.
I guess I'll have to buy my ticket, I think.
Bye-bye. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Bye. Well, that was very nice of John to join us. I like I said, I read him all the time.
Why don't you date him? No, sorry.
I knew you guys thought I was going to be sucking up, but between him and Patrick Goldstein, I really have been very impressed with the way the LA Times has been covering the industry. And I know the LA Times gets a lot of flack. And frankly, I think it's just de rigueur to dump on mainstream media and newspapers these days. So everybody dumps on the LA Times, but they have been doing a great job in that section.
Well, that was a really good article, and I think it was very fair to them, especially since they didn't speak to him, and did get you excited by the show creatively, though revealing details that they may not like. Well, it's a huge budget film, and apparently huge budgets aren't unusual in Hollywood because Nicolas Cage's life has a huge budget from what we can tell. The LA Times, again, a story from then, has a story about Nicolas Cage suing his former money manager, Samuel J. Levine, for $20 million in LA Superior Court, claiming he enriched himself, meaning Levine, while, quote, sending Cage down a path toward financial ruin. I find it just inherently sad that actors can't find anyone to look after their stuff who doesn't rip them off or who they believe rips them off. But the story is chock full of stuff about Nicolas Cage's private life and his spending habits. It claims that he spent a decade buying homes, motorcycles, yachts, vintage and new cars, expensive watches, meteorites, dinosaur skulls, an enormous pet collection someone refers to as basically a zoo, massive amounts of jewelry for women in his life, group vacations,
and some of which he tossed overboard. I mean,
is this really insane?
You know,
yeah?
I look at all this and I'm like, I mean, spendthrift is like, you know, wow, putting it lightly, but you know, I don't know who this Samuel Levin is, but why can't actors be keeping an eye on their money? I mean, I know that seems like rather a naive question to even be considering to ask, but
I think it gets too complex financially. I mean, it's a full-time job. You need somebody that you can trust because it's not, you know, when you're talking tens of millions of dollars, it's not like, you know, how much do I have in my account so I can pay my phone bill like it is for me?
Yeah, but didn't they get him for not paying his taxes?
They got him twice.
Yeah, again, another reason why you need accountants and people.
That's a phone call. Hey, Sam, did I pay my taxes? They just don't care. They don't pay attention. I find that really just, wow.
The article says that in June 2004, he owned 18 motorcycles and 30 cars, according to a member of his entourage.
Why do you need that?
But that's nothing compared to Seinfeld, who bought an entire building on the Upper West Side in order to house his car collection. But Sperling, you've been awfully quiet while we talk about Nicolas Cage's finances. Why is that?
On the grounds that I could incriminate myself, I should probably remain silent because I used to work as an executive at Nicolas Cage's production company and was there during, I guess, the early part of his spendthrift ways based on the story, which, by the way, was in The Daily Beast. The LA Times story was just referencing the story in The Daily Beast, which is a very long story. The writer for The Daily Beast got a lot of inside information from anonymous sources, and I'll tell you, having worked for him, it's very interesting to kind of cherry pick who I think actually said that, knowing his personal assistant or knowing the executives at his production company. And
yeah, I've got my own guesses too.
I'm sure. Well, you know, Norm Golightly for years worked.
Oh, I'm like, are we going to talk about this? Are we going to actually give out names?
You know, they talk a lot about his house in Bel Air, which was once owned by Dean Martin and Tom Jones, and Nicolas Cage put it on the market for $30 million a year or so ago, and then only sold it for $15 million this year. Well, you know, I know he only bought it for between $3 and $8 million, so of course he actually is making money on that. And he was using a lot of his properties as investments.
Right, he has two mansions in New Orleans. Again, yeah, it makes it sound like he's living in 20 homes. He's buying properties and reselling them and, you know, reaping the profits.
Right, and the problem with the New Orleans homes is that they've been repossessed. And so, I mean, businesses go through cash flow problems, as do people, apparently, and movie stars. I thought it was far more interesting that they started to talk about how he very well might be bipolar because one of the symptoms of being bipolar is going on shopping sprees. I did find it very funny to hear about all of his cars. Certainly when I worked for him, he had a lot of cars. He was a car collector, much like Jay Leno was. He collected them as investments.
Mm-hmm.
One of the best stories I have of working with Nicolas Cage, and I don't think he would mind me saying this, is he had a personal chef, as do many people who work in Hollywood, at least people of Nicolas Cage's caliber. And he came into the office one day and he was editing a film, Shadow of the Vampire, with the director and the editor. And his personal chef came in and with the toaster oven made a gourmet meal. And he had brought two bottles of wine, and the chef had opened one of the bottles, and Nicholas took a little sip and went, "Oh, it's very good, very good. Yeah, that's
great." That was good.
That was really good.
And he went back into the editing room for a moment, and the chef looked at me and said, "You know how much that bottle of wine is?" And I was like, "Oh, I don't know, like, what, $100? He went, "Yeah, no, more like $600. This was actually the most surreal moment of my life, because I was eating lunch, this gourmet lunch, drinking wine with Nicolas Cage. And I said, "Oh, Nick, you know, you probably, you know, I have this tape of from Saturday Night Live last week where, you know, they did an impression of you on Celebrity Jeopardy." And I'm sitting there watching Nicolas Cage watch somebody do an impression of him on Saturday Night Live while eating a gourmet meal.
Made in a toaster oven.
Made in a toaster oven by his personal chef. It was it was kind of an out-of-body experience.
I love the story about the Bentley. It describes him buying over six figures, which I guess means $1 million or more, on a Bentley. Then got it refitted with custom cabinetry. A TV, stereo, and bar were all put in. But the renovation cost total more than $50,000. When it was done, he couldn't fit into the back seat.
I can tell you what happened to that Bentley. Or at least one of the Bentleys that he had, because he had two Bentleys and he had a driver. And one of the Bentleys that he did that to, he was on his way to the Tonight Show to promote, I want to say it was Snake Eyes or one of his summer films. Maybe it was Gone in 60 Seconds. I can't recall. But he was on the way there and the show called and said, "Look, where is he? He never showed up." Well, apparently he was in an accident. A 16-year-old driver turned left into the Bentley, going through a red light, taking the entire front of the Bentley off.
Ooh.
She had gotten her driver's license a week before and was driving her parents' car. And all I could think of is, oh my goodness, that poor girl. She had no idea that not only was she hitting, you know, some celebrity on his way to the Tonight Show, but the cost of that car was like $300,000 or $400,000. So her insurance rates, I'm sure, skyrocketed after that.
Another good story is the story that Sperling wrote this week, a very complicated story about the MPAA and movie theaters and whether studios want to start zipping movies into your home digitally and do a runaround on the movie theaters, or what's going on here. It was a very inside industry story, Sperling. Could you set it up for us and explain to us what it's all about?
Really what's going on here, and it's been going on for a number of years, is that in 2003, the Motion Picture Association of America, the MPAA, this is the lobbying group for the movie studios here in Hollywood. They have been lobbying the FCC to do what is called selectable output control, which would allow them to control how a feed is transmitted to a television set. And they can do this through HDMI, so through high definition, this high definition cable, because HDMI has HDCP or high definition copy protection. Meaning that it can only, you know, your DVD player or your satellite or cable set-top box can only send a particular show or a particular piece of content from the device into the television set through the HDMI cable and into the HDMI port on the television set. Well, the FCC in 2003 said, yeah, it's nice that you want that MPAA, but actually what we're going to do, since consumers in their homes mix and match their equipment, and some people have high-end equipment which can do all of this HDMI stuff and others can't, we're going to say that you can't transmit a stream through just one output. If it goes through the HDMI output, it also has to go through the RCA analog outputs, which of course leaves this big, giant analog hole. So this is why it's a very insider-ish kind of story, because it's a little bit geeky to try and explain this whole thing. It's very techie, I suppose. Everybody's kind of up in arms because Public Knowledge, which is a public consumer rights group, is saying, look, the MPAA is now asking for this waiver to do SOC for an early release. And what they mean by early release, though they did not define it in their letters or their waiver request, the studios want to be able to release movies for video on demand or streaming early. They want to have it in the theater and maybe on video on demand at the same time. Or they want to have it in the theater for 3 weeks, and then as the box office starts to taper off, release it for video on demand.
I thought that they were saying, sorry to interrupt, I thought that somebody in one of the comment sections on one of these stories clarified, maybe they were wrong, that actually they don't want to release it on demand at the same time. They want to release it on demand like 2 months later.
Yes, that's what they're claiming now, but the National Association of Theater Owners and John Fithian, who's the president of that organization, believe that what they're really trying to do is do what's called day and date releasing, meaning they'll release it on DVD, video on demand, and theatrically all at the same time.
Which is something Steven Soderbergh tried 5 years ago.
Right, with Bubble, and it completely failed because his
Didn't fail because it's a non-movie that was never going to have a big demand of audience. I mean, IFC and other people, you know, make things available video on demand the day they put them in movie theaters. It's just those are very tiny films that aren't going to draw a big audience. But your argument to clarify all this rigmarole is that they're not really arguing about changing all this window, collapsing window stuff. It's really just a backdoor way of trying to fight piracy by adding some more digital control over a movie when they send it into people's homes.
That's right. But I do believe that the studios, if they had their choice, would actually do day and date releases on some films. Maybe not Transformers. Maybe not, you know.
It'd be stupid. What movie would you do it on?
Just smaller art house fare where they could get maybe people living in rural areas where the film will never open, or, mm-hmm. you know, parents who have young children who might not be able to make it to the theater to see, not Slumdog Millionaire, but maybe An Education, which is a small art film, or mm-hmm. Bright Star, another small art film that premiered at Cannes. So I think that's really what they're gearing up to do. And, of course, theater owners throughout the country are just up in arms about this. The reality is, in what you're saying, Michael, I agree that they are, and that's what I said in my piece on Celluloid Junkie, which is the studios are trying to get something that they were denied the first time, and they're hiding behind this, we want to do this service where we, you know, allow parents to see movies. And
people in wheelchairs. We want to help people in wheelchairs see movies.
Right.
Yeah, so I love that.
Isn't it great that we can provide this service? And what public knowledge is saying is, look, you can offer that service without messing with the windows or messing with any of the
SOC,
which is, again, selectable output control.
And really, it's kind of stupid, isn't it? I mean, they always think they need to put all these digital controls and these complicated technological fixes to try and fight pirates. But then 4 weeks later, they're going to send out DVDs to all over the country. And all that ends up happening is that normal people who want to just listen to their album online or watch a movie find all sorts of blocks and weird ways that keep them from using the film and the music the legal way that they want to. They just make it hard for consumers.
That's right. Usually things and legislation such as this and technology such as this actually penalize the people who are paying for the content in the first place. I do think that the exhibitors should probably start to get ready for the studios to start moving windows around and closing the theatrical release window, at least on some films. It's going to happen. Now, the question is, will moving a video-on-demand release window closer to the theatrical release or doing it day and date, will that create more moviegoers in the long run? Much the way having an iTunes store actually created more music listeners.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense to me when you talk about something like An Education or some art film that's not going to go on 1,000 screens. And that would make sense for video-on-demand. Certainly, they're not going to do it for a big summer blockbuster. They're not going to put Avatar on day and date. So I don't think theater owners should be that upset. It's going to be to fill in the blanks for the movies that can't play all across the country.
Well, David Poland, who has, of course, appeared on our show previously on previous episodes. How many times can I use the word previous in one sentence? he writes for Movie City News. He's the editor of Movie City News. And he said studios are scrambling as DVD has turned softer to figure out how to maximize all revenue streams and to understand just how much money is possible in each. The answer is whatever combination of delivery systems with whatever kinds of windows will portend the greatest amount of revenue for the majority of studio-level films. And he was really the only writer that I saw, besides Ann Thompson, who kind of touched on it a little bit, talk about how this is probably not just about windows. This is more about getting something that they were once denied.
Well, good. He caught up on what you wrote about in your piece.
Right.
And did and I wonder, did anybody catch up with V, which debuted on ABC? It had the biggest debut of any, I believe, any show in the of the fall.
What was the biggest science fiction television show debut this fall?
Oh, it had science fiction. That's how they qualified it?
I don't know. It had 13.9 million viewers. The season premiere on last Tuesday, which is pretty good. The original V, which was in 1983, just to give you some, to put it in perspective, the original V had 21 million viewers. Now, in 1983, remember, very, very little cable penetration, no satellite penetration to speak of whatsoever, no DVRs, no people meters. So now, with all of this new technology in place, it drops to 13.9 million people. So the audience is definitely fragmented. I did get a chance to see it. Did it? Did either of you?
Uh-huh.
No.
What did you think of it?
You know, I didn't think it was great, but I found it such a relief after Fast Forward and Lost and all these shows and Fringe. I knew what it was. They set it up. There's the aliens. We know they're evil. There's a rebellion. We know some aliens are good. Some aliens are bad. We've got the mother who's fighting in the rebellion and the son who's being lured into working with the aliens. He doesn't really, you know, it was just, I'm sure there are things that are going to get revealed, but whatever, you know, I knew what it was. It was clear. It was obvious and it was straightforward. It wasn't, you know, endless backstory and twists and turns that are going to develop over months. You have no idea what's going on. I kind of found it a relief in that way.
Are you going to continue watching it?
I'm going to dip into it. It wasn't great, but I would dip into it to see if they gain momentum or how it builds week to week.
I love the fact that all the V's are like totally beautiful women and gorgeous men, and there's not an ugly one among them.
That's different from the original miniseries, which, by the way, was on all last weekend on the Sci-Fi Channel. I, of course, was watching it because I'm a dork. Sperling, what did you think of it?
I thought the writing was just atrocious, but I was very interested in, I mean, that's a lot of special effects work in a network show like that. It was pretty good for a network television show to have that level of special effects work.
What do you think of ABC's decision to kind of roll it out? They're doing like four episodes now and then it disappears until January.
I think it could either work or not work. How about that?
Way to be on a
that's
limb.
That's deep. To me, it indicated that they didn't believe in the show because it was almost like giving themselves an out.
It's November sweeps. It's the hottest time of the programming season. So they're showing confidence in the show. It's like Glee, where they say, we're going to show it to you now in the hottest period of the, and then we're going to, not December and all that when there's reruns and the holidays, and then we're going to go full blast in January. I think it shows confidence.
That didn't work for Lost, and I don't think it's going to work here.
So Karen says it's a big whoop that V premiered, and I think it's a big deal that they played it during November sweeps.
Is that your way of saying we should move on to our ever popular segment, Big Deal or Big Whoop?
There should be prizes. I feel like it's a game show in the making. Big Deal, Big Whoop.
Okay, well, our first story this week is groups urge CW stations to stop airing Gossip Girl.
Yeah, I put this one on. The ever popular Parents Television Council is like up in arms because the episode of Gossip Girl, which airs tonight, the 9th of November, is about a threesome. Or at least that's what they have been hinting at, like all week, is what it's going to be.
Wait,
about.
It's about a on-air
a threesome.
Wow. Hold on.
Can we pause while I need to set my DVR? Can we take a break?
Yeah, I gotta. anyway, we can be downloaded on iTunes.
Thank you very much. Go ahead.
Email us.
CW.com or CWTV.com. I know, right? So, like, I mean, just look at YouTube.
I'm going to say big deal.
There was a still, and I can't tell whether it's two girls and a guy or two guys and a girl.
Oh, they did that on purpose. They don't want you to know, which is why, you know, just mark my words. Okay, there was no threesome.
Two guys.
Maybe they talk about it. Maybe like someone like accidentally walks in on somebody. Maybe someone's dog watches. Believe me, it's not going to be a big deal. If it was, I'm sure we'd be seeing a little bit more. But
November sweeps.
But yeah, well, exactly. I know. But I put this on here not because necessarily that Gossip Girl having a threesome, whether that's a big deal, because I'm sure we all agreed probably is, even though I'm telling you. We talk tomorrow, it'll be a big whoop. But the fact that Parents Television Council, which I don't know if you guys are as familiar with it, I wrote a piece on this when Janet Jackson revealed her boobs. So I'm kind of a little bit more familiar with them. But the fact that they urge stations to do this, big deal, big whoop.
big whoop because none of their boycotts have worked for years. The far right has tried to boycott Disney. They try to boycott General Motors. They try to boycott, you know, CW, tell them to drop one of their two or three most popular shows. They don't even take a reasonable stance like, shouldn't they downplay their ads and not make it so hellaciously salacious? You know, they come up with this ridiculous idea. Don't air the show.
Yeah, I agree. Big whoop that they want it to be a big deal. Sperling?
Big whoop that this group tried to contact CW affiliates to get them to not air Gossip Girl. Big deal that there's a threesome. So I'm going to...
Thank you for letting us know.
And thank you. Yes. This will be the very first episode of Gossip Girl I ever watch.
All right. So moving on. The next one that's under this, I put it on too. Have you guys heard of the Hollywood Hills burglar bunch?
Yes, they robbed me blind.
Not till you told us about it. Tell us about it.
Well, first of all, it started off that we just heard about, like, you know, Jessica Alba or somebody of that ilk was robbed while she was, you know, on The Tonight Show. And then we hear that, like, you know, Audrina Patridge from The Hills, she was robbed while she was off filming, you know, episode of The Hills. And you slowly kind of started to notice a pattern that these young girls, that they kept getting robbed when they were off doing something. And sure enough, there was a bunch of kids, I mean, 19 to like 22, who would pay attention to where these girls said that they were going to be, or just to pay attention to their schedules, which is really easy to do nowadays, and would go to their homes and burgle them while they were out.
So Miley Cyrus tweets that I'm on location on my film, and they head to her home.
Yes.
With the safe cracking tools and some dynamite.
I mean, this is probably a big whoop because, you know, it's really not that huge a story, but I'm sorry. Big deal. That's smart.
I'm going to go with big deal here, mainly because nowadays with social networks and Twitter and Facebook, a celebrity's whereabouts and what they're up to are being broadcast to the masses. So it's not that hard to find out where a celebrity lives nowadays. So yeah, this could happen more often.
Yeah, that's true. I counsel my celebrity clients to not ever, ever Twitter where they are. Ever. Or even where they're going, unless it's someplace, you know, obvious and public.
Like they're going to be in a...
And when I say if it's something that somebody couldn't Google, you know, somebody's going to be on The Tonight Show or something, then that's okay. But don't ever say, I'm going to, you know, the, you know, Century City Mall tomorrow at a Christmas shop. No, uh-uh. No.
I say it's a big deal, too. I love that in one of the articles, in HollywoodGossip.com, it says that they found a hat linked to Lindsay Lohan, jeans linked to Rachel Bilson.
it's awesome, right?
Linked to Paris Hilton?
But with, you know, unemployment rates among teens hitting 25%, I think these kids are showing a lot of initiative, and it makes me feel good about the country and our future.
Wow. Well, I'm going to skip over one of our big deal, big whoops. It's just basically about the Twilight stars denying that they're having a romance. So I'm skipping over it because, you know what? I personally don't care. And we're running long on time. And I'm going to go right to Oprah leaves daytime television. According to Nikki Fink, she's saying that in several weeks, Oprah Winfrey will tell the public that she's ending her syndicated Chicago-based daytime talk show when her current deal runs out, and moving it to OWN, which is the Oprah Winfrey Network. She's moving it to Los Angeles probably as soon as mid-2011. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a huge deal.
Well, if it actually happens, it's a big deal. Frankly, my feeling is what's a big deal about this is that her deal for OWN is with Discovery Communications, which has the Discovery Channel, and they have been pushing her to finally get off her derriere and get the network up and running. Otherwise, they're just going to drop it. So she's got to do something to anchor it, and it very well may be her own show.
Well, I say it's a big whoop because, first of all, she's been threatening to leave daytime television show for about the past decade. Every year, there's rumors that she might end it. Now she's not even ending it. She's just moving it to cable. But I don't understand this. Didn't she help launch Oxygen? And she has her after show thing on Oxygen and reruns on that. I mean, isn't that her network too? Why does she need another network? What is she going to do with OWN that's different than Oxygen?
She's Oprah Winfrey. She's big enough for two networks.
I guess, but if she just keeps doing her show on cable instead of daytime, how's that a big deal in any way, shape, or form?
Look,
Oprah,
Michael,
will still be part of our lives. We'll still be reading the books she tells us to.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Michael, how could you not understand? How is she ever going to do her Network of the Month Club if she has only one network? And that, by the way, should be our inside baseball story for the week because we don't have one. So
Well,
we had enough inside baseball this whole show, so we should probably wrap up here. Now, Michael, your work can be found on michaelgiltz.com, also on the Huffington Post. You can be followed on Twitter. At Michael Giltz is the username to look up. Karen, your username on Twitter is at kwoody3939. And your writing can be read on industrynexus.com as well as Karen Woodward online. Is that correct?
Yep.
I can be followed on Twitter. At Sperling is the username to look up. And you can read the story that we discussed previously on celluloidjunkie.com. If you want to look up any of the stories we discussed on this episode of Showbiz Sandbox, you can visit our website, which can be found at showbizsandbox.com, and you can look them up in the show notes for episode 28. That is also where you will find links to all of our social networking accounts, including Twitter, where our username is at showbizsandbox. If you want to email us to discuss any of the stories that we talked about or send us some feedback or call us names, you can do so. The email address is dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also leave us a voicemail by calling 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each of our episodes is by MGMT, the popular indie rock group. You can find them at MySpace, myspace.com/MGMT, or on their own website, whoismgmt.com.
By the way, breaking news, Walt Disney Studios President Mark Zoradi resigns. Sorry.
Really?
Really?
Yes, after 29 years.
Yeah, just throw that. Yeah, I'm sure he resigned. Let's see. Dick Cook in September, now Mark Zoradi now. I just saw him last week at Show East. That's so weird. In any case, if you want to subscribe to this podcast, you can do so at the iTunes store. We encourage you to do so. Until next week, play nice.